Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Global security, the refugee crisis, and political instability are focal points for Secretary of State John Kerry and other Group of Seven foreign ministers. They have wrapped up their first day of talks in Japan. Their two-day meeting is underway in Hiroshima. In an interview with the Hiroshima newspaper, Kerry said the most global threats to international peace require collective action. Meanwhile, Russia's foreign ministry says the Secretary of State John Kerry and the Russian foreign minister Sergei Lavrov have stressed the need for more cooperation between their two countries to strengthen the ceasefire in Syria. The ministry statement said that during Sunday's phone conversations, Lavrov and Kerry also discussed efforts to fight the Islamic State group, as well as the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Nusra Front and other terrorist organizations, agreeing to take additional measures to halt the flow of militants and weapons from abroad. Lavrov's office said the two diplomats expressed support for the efforts of the UN envoy to Syria. U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter is in India during a wave of increased cooperation with India's military. Carter is looking to improve defense technology and trade cooperation while increasing military-to-military cooperation through additional bilateral and trilateral coordinated operations. Saudi Arabia's monarch addressed the Egyptian parliament Sunday, where he announced plans to build a bridge linking the two nations across the Red Sea. In his six-minute address, King Salman said the Arab countries need to work together to combat violent extremism, and he advocated a unified vision for a united Arab military force. This is VOA News. Nigeria's information minister is denying media reports the Islamist militant group Boko Haram is demanding $50 million from the government as ransom before releasing the abducted Chibok schoolgirls. President Muhammadu Buhari promised to do all he can to ensure the release of the schoolgirls after his recent meeting with parents of the girls at his presidential villa in the capital of Abuja. Meanwhile, the country's information minister says ransom reports are not new. Ukraine's embattled Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk said Sunday that he's resigning. It opens the way for a new government to be formed and in an effort to end Kiev's political crisis. Yatsenyuk said in a televised speech and Twitter comments that he hopes his resignation would give Ukraine a chance to adopt new electoral, constitutional, and judicial reforms, as well as to join the European Union and NATO. He said he's to formally submit his resignation to Parliament on Tuesday. At least 100 people died and hundreds of others were injured in a massive fire that broke out at a temple in the southern Indian state of Kerala early today, where thousands had gathered to witness a fireworks display being held as part of an annual religious festival. A stampede ensued as panic spread and many people were injured as they were trying to flee those flames. Disaster teams have reached that location, and the Kerala chief minister said permission had not been granted for that fireworks display, and temple authorities had flouted rules in conducting it. Meanwhile, the Indian prime minister headed to the disaster site with a team of specialist doctors. Belgium prosecutors have charged four more suspects linked to the deadly suicide bombings in Brussels last month. They killed 32 people. The Belgian Prime Minister, Charles Michel, speaking through an interpreter, said his government and security forces will continue to be vigilant even with the new arrests.
But we all know very well that we have to stay very alert and that we have to be very careful. That is why we are taking the needed measures. I can only repeat that at this very moment, a lot of military and police people are on the ground to maintain our level of security.
You can read more details on that story at voanews.com. Migrants wage running battles with Macedonian police on Sunday after they were stopped from scaling the border fence with Greece near the border town of Idomeni. And aid agencies have reported that hundreds of stranded travelers were injured. Macedonian police used tear gas and stun grenades, as well as plastic bullets and water cannon, to repel the migrants. A strong earthquake centered in northeastern Afghanistan rattled parts of Central and Southeast Asia today. It registered at 6.6. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
It appears there are several versions of this report. The one that we had was that from the source that they wanted to release 10 of these girls for 1 million euros.
The Nigerian government denies media reports that Boko Haram is demanding a ransom before releasing the Chibok girls.
This is very unfortunate. First of all, it is a hate speech by the chief of general staff of the government's army. This means that is anti-peace and anti-democracy.
A statement by the South Sudanese Army Chief of Staff sparks controversy.
You must look at the gorillas into the eyes, make him know that you are not afraid of him. You should not run. If you run, that is where it can be risky. No matter the movement that he's doing, you should just be static.
And poaching and environmental degradation threaten the gorilla population in southern Cameroon. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Nigerian Information Minister is denying media reports that Islamist militant group Boko Haram is demanding $50 million from the government as ransom before releasing the abducted Chibok school girls. President Muhammadu Buhari promised to all he can to ensure the release of the schoolgirls following his recent meeting with parents of the abducted girls at the presidential villa in the capital, Abuja. Information Minister Lai Mohammed told me that ransom reports are not new.
It appears there are several versions of this report. The one that we had was that from the source that they wanted to release 10 of these girls for 1 million euros. But the important thing is that we've gone through this route before. And until and when we establish the credibility of this source and the fear and the truth behind it, the government will not be in a hurry to make a statement. However, government is also using its own channels to authenticate the credibility of this source.
Is the government making efforts to bring these girls back home, particularly when President Muhammadu Buhari promised that he would do everything he can to ensure their safe return? Is the government doing enough?
I'm not telling Peter that no day passes without the issue of the kidnapped Boko Haram girls being, you know, on the front burner. But, you know, these are highly security and intelligence, you know, issues, and which cannot always be discussed, you know, openly. But I can assure you that for this government, the return of these girls is what is going to bring a final closure on the Boko Haram, you know, terrorism. And we're working very hard daily on it.
The government critics are saying that the government appears not to be doing enough. The government appears not to be giving any information to the parent of those abducted schoolgirls, and that despite repeated promises, the government has yet to make any significant progress in this regard. What do you say to that?
Well, I think those who say that have been very unfair to us. We inherited a very bad situation where the trail had gone cold. But despite that, we every day we send out reports, we receive feelers. Some of them are phoning, some of them are just there to express government. But the truth of the matter is that it's not a matter the government is taking lightly. Those who want a daily report on what we are doing, of course, in security, that does not happen. But we have channels of information which we make available to on a need-to-know basis.
What will you say is the progress report on the fight against terrorism, particularly Boko Haram in Nigeria?
I think without any equivocation, Nigeria has achieved a rare feat in the fight against Boko Haram terrorism. You see, there are three ways in which an insurgency like Boko Haram could be terminated. One is for the insurgents, to win and impose their ways of life and their government over the people, as happened in several parts of the world. Another is for both parties to reach a negotiated settlement, as happened again in South Africa, Guatemala, and other parts of the world. And it's only in the rare, very rarely does the government completely root out the insurgency. This is the one we have achieved in Nigeria. Today, we do not have Boko Haram holding any sovereign authority on any of our soil. Today, we dislodge them from their fortresses. Today, we have driven them away from where they used to occupy. And what we have today is nothing but, cowardly attacks on their sub-targets. And Nigeria has moved on, and we are now concentrating very much on the rehabilitation, resettlement of those who are displaced. And I think the fact that one of the most wanted persons, all over the world, was captured without even firing a shot last week, that is number two person, Panawi, I think is evidence of the success of Nigeria in dealing with terrorism.
What would you say, for instance, with their latest round of suicide attacks, turning some of these captives into suicide bombers, particularly girls or women for that matter?
Well, you see, Peter, the issue of soft targets, suicide bombers, is not limited to Nigeria, not limited to Boko Haram. It's a global issue, it's a global concern, and it needs for all countries in the world to exchange intelligence. It's important for all countries in the world to work together. I mean, look at what happened in Paris in November 2015, or what happened in Brussels, a few weeks ago. So, nobody should, you cannot take the issue, you can't say because there's actually an increase in violence and increase in the in suicide bombers to mean there's an increase in insurgency or that something has not been dealt with. The truth of the matter, and I'm sure the international community knows that Nigeria has achieved a very rare feat in defeating Boko Haram.
Lai Mohammed is the Nigerian Information Minister. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Lagos. The United Nations is calling for collective action to combat violent extremism. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has told more than 700 delegates attending the first ever conference on preventing extreme violence they have to tackle its root causes to defeat it. For VOA, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva on the last day of the two-day conference.
Terrorism and extreme violence are not new phenomena. They have been around for decades. But UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says modern technology like smartphones, along with social media outlets and advanced modes of transportation, have allowed the twin scourges to spread like a cancer. Ban says countering the threats by centering on security and military action have not worked. He adds these methods have limits and often are counterproductive. Ban says it is time to try a new approach.
We need a more comprehensive and balanced approach that addresses the drivers of violent extremism. I think we should invest and focus more on prevention.
That, he says, involves the need to address the root causes of what drives people, particularly youth, to become radicalized and join terrorist organizations such as the Islamic State militant group and Boko Haram. In order to successfully tackle this issue, Ban says it is necessary to focus on the large number of disaffected youth. He says young people who feel marginalized, alienated, or isolated from society are vulnerable to extremist messages.
They have no job, no socioeconomic opportunities, and women groups, girls, they have a lot of violence happening while international community has not been able to effectively address root causes of this.
The UN chief has submitted a 5-point plan of action to the conference. It focuses on harnessing the idealism, creativity, and energy of 1.8 billion young people around the world. The plan emphasizes conflict prevention and offers a list of 79 recommendations for member states to devise their own national plans of action to counter violent extremism. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The South Sudanese opposition faction is calling recent comment by the country's Army Chief of Staff anti-peace and anti-democracy. Last week, Army Chief of Staff Paul Malonga once said, as long as he lives, former Vice President and rebel leader Dr. Riek Machar will never become president of the world's newest nation. But Machar spokesman James Gadet Dak condemned Awan's comment as an unfortunate reminder that there are senior political and military officials of the government in Juba who are not for peace and democracy.
This is very unfortunate. First of all, it is a hate speech by the Chief of General Staff of the government's army. This means that is anti-peace and anti-democracy, because there is no way an individual can stop a political leader from aspiring for a political position like the presidency. This indicates that the government is not committed to peace, and this has raised serious concern about the way the peace agreement, the implementation of the peace agreement is heading. This means there is underlying plan by General Paul Malonga one to violate the peace agreement and even to harm Dr. Machar.
There are some people who say that these are General Awan's personal opinion and do not necessarily reflect the views of the government in Juba led by President Salva Kiir. What is your take?
I don't believe this, because if this is the case, first of all, a senior military leader like Paul Malong would not have said this without the backing of the rest of the government or the president and the commander-in-chief of the army, President Salva Kiir. And if they don't share the comment made by Paul Malong, then they would have come out and denounced it and distanced the rest of the government from it. But their silence has confirmed that they share the comment.
Supporters of the government are saying that his pronouncement should not necessarily affect Dr. Riek Machar from his trip that he has planned for April 18 to go to Juba, take up his position for a new transitional government to be formed. Do you agree with that?
Yes, it will not affect the planned return of Dr. Riek Machar per se. But if there are underlying plans by General Paul Malong to continue with whatever he plans to violate the peace agreement or to make it difficult for Dr. Machar to return, this will be another thing. But as per the comment, yes, it will not affect it. The plan for Dr. Machar to return on the 18th of April is still in place. Still, we are worried that the comment may be backed by negative actions. As you can see, his visit to Western Bahar Ghazal State has resulted to government offensive against our positions in the area. So these are the concerns.
So are you therefore expressing a deep suspicion based on his pronouncement?
Yes, I do. I do. I think he has a plan to try to disrupt the implementation of the peace agreement and the return of the first vice president designate.
So what is your next line of action, if I may ask, based on this pronouncement from the general?
Well, we would have wished that President Salva Kiir comes out denouncing what his army chief of staff has declared, which is anti-peace, which is anti-democracy. This would, clear the air and assure the rest that what the chief of staff has said is not shared by the president. But the silence is not good, is not helping, although we are not saying that this will result to our denouncing of the trip to Juba by the first vice president. But we would have wished that the president comes out and denounce what these civil servants say.
James Gadet Dak is the spokesman for the South Sudanese rebel leader, Dr. Riek Machar. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. It's a familiar sight in many developing countries, children younger than 10 years old lighting up cigarettes, some hooked on 1 to 2 packs a day. Anti-tobacco groups say it is the result of the cigarette manufacturers run amok in places where smoking regulations are weak or non-existent. But if they can get children and their parents to just say no, public officials say they can make a huge dent in disease and deaths caused by smoking worldwide. VOA's Jessica Berman has more.
In countries including the Philippines, India, and South Africa, children can be seen smoking. In an extreme example, a video of an Indonesian 2-year-old lighting up went viral on the internet. It's estimated that 41% of boys in Indonesia between the ages of 13 and 15 smoke cigarettes regularly. They see billboards advertising cigarettes a short distance from schools, and children can buy cigarettes cheaply at kiosks run by tobacco companies.
When we see somebody dying of lung cancer or oral cancer in adulthood, virtually always that's the last chapter in a book that began with a child.
Matt Myers is president of the group Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. The organization aims to cut the number of adult daily smokers, estimated to be 740 million people worldwide, by actively partnering with countries to adopt anti-tobacco programs and policies.
If we can cut off that spigot, if we can prevent people from ever starting, then we will be able to win the long-term effort.
Deaths from diseases such as lung cancer and heart disease are now considered a global public health emergency. Smoking is a major culprit. 10 years ago, the World Health Organization adopted the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control to snuff out the use of cigarettes and other tobacco products. The world body, through its Non-Communicable Diseases Action Plan, has set a goal to reduce smoking by 30% over 2010 levels by 2025, and it's made progress. The percentage of people lighting up has gone down worldwide, but population growth means there are more smokers than ever before. Meyer says tobacco companies see their future in young smokers in less affluent countries. But he says anti-tobacco forces are making strides.
2 years ago, for the first time in recorded history, total cigarette sales across the globe were down. And that's a direct result of those countries that have taken action beginning to see positive progress. We have a long way to go, but in many countries, we have turned the corner.
Countries where progress has been seen have forced tobacco companies to put graphic pictures of smoking-related diseases on their packs, enacting advertising bans, and placed stiff taxes on tobacco products, all to discourage cigarette smoking by young and old alike. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Critics and analysts have described as grandstanding and cheap politicking promises by President Robert Mugabe that he is ready to step down anytime if his party or the people say so. Addressing thousands of former freedom fighters in the capital, Harare, Mugabe condemned elements in his ZANU-PF party fighting for his position, saying he was still firmly in charge. Political analyst Brilliant Langa tells VOA Zimbabwe Studio Services in Tungamili, Nkomo, that President Mugabe is simply bluffing and has no desire to leave office.
So you are sort of daring people to say, well, if you feel you no longer want me, tell me directly. But he knows that no one is going to tell him that. Even when he invited the war veterans, he invited them, obviously, as a stunt of daring them to say, well, come and tell me this after I've beaten you up and water-hosed you the way he did a couple of months ago. So he is clear on what he's doing, that he is daring everyone, he's challenging them. He actually understands that he is, in fact, indeed the center of power and a kind of king, a monarchical leader. This is basically what he was saying there.
If people in ZANU-PF are really fed up with Mr. Mugabe, why then can they not tell him to step down? Because he says if that were to happen, he would oblige.
Well, the reality is that he has created over the years this culture of him being infallible, this culture of him being this very fearsome leader. So the point is, people in ZANU do not respect him anymore. They actually fear him. So they cannot tell him directly. But it's natural. You can clearly see that people don't want him.
Brilliant Mlanga is a Zimbabwean political analyst. He spoke with VOA's Zimbabwe Studio Services reporter Ntangamila Nkomo from Britain. Poaching and environmental degradation are threatening the gorilla population in southern Cameroon. One young woman is trying to change the trend. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Campo Man National Park.
Anoge Farms approaches gorillas fighting over food.
It is easy to meet a gorilla. When we have contact with them, we do certain signs with our tongue, like clapping our hands so that they should respond to us. When we do those signs, they will be curious towards us, they will come closer to us, and they will start barking and they will shout, vocalizing, like just to defend their territory.
The 28-year-old has been living in the camp since early 2015. She sees herself as a diplomat of sorts between humans and gorillas, a relationship that has grown strained in recent years, to say the least. In Cameroon, gorillas and monkeys are hunted mainly for bush meat. Baby primates are captured and sold as pets. There is also a growing black market trade in primate parts, believed to have therapeutic and mystical values. When I try to approach a gorilla, as she does, she grabs my hand and shouts.
No, they're not friendly to men, but we are trying to make them to be friendly to us. That is, when you come towards them, you must respect all the methods. You must not turn your back on the gorillas. You must look at the gorillas into the eyes. Make him know that you are not afraid of him. You should not run. If you run, that is where it can be risky. No matter the movement that he's doing, you should just be static. He will turn, he will charge, and he will leave.
France studied environmental science at the University of Maroua. She now works for a World Wildlife Fund project launched in 2011 to protect the mammals here. Campo Man is vast. The preserve stretches over 700,000 hectares on the border with Equatorial Guinea, but park officials say there are only about 300 cross-river gorillas left here. And gorillas are not just a tourist attraction. They graze widely and play a role in maintaining the natural balance of the ecosystem. France tries to convince the locals to stop poaching and protect the natural habitat of the animals, which are the main causes of the animals disappearing. She's talked to local leaders like Eric Fotso of the Bamileke ethnic group.
Ces espèces protégées, c'est important pour la nature, c'est vrai, mais comment est-ce que ces populations...
He says he understands her message that gorillas are very important for the conservation of nature, but he says he will not stop buying and selling them because he has no other means of economic survival. He says the government needs to help them find alternative sources of income. France argues that protecting the gorilla population will drive tourism to the park. She says that revenue could fund conservation efforts and help develop the area, improving living standards for the local population. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Campo, Cameroon.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the International Criminal Court and African leaders
as well as ICC's ruling on Kenya's Deputy President William Ruto. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Good evening, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In boxing, Manny Pacquiao beat Timothy Bradley by unanimous decision in what the Filipino says is the final fight of his career. All three judges scored Pacquiao winner by 116 to 110 on Saturday in the match between the pair in Las Vegas. The 37-year-old Pacquiao knocked down American Bradley in the 7th and 9th rounds in the third welterweight meeting between the two. Pacquiao, who bounced back from a split decision defeat by Bradley in 2012 with a decisive win 2 years later, looked the more menacing fighter after a KJ opening round. Bradley landed occasionally, but Pacquiao caught the American on the chin in the second round and stretched his lead further with a knockdown in the 7th. A second knockdown followed in the 9th, despite a Bradley left hook wobbling the Filipino around earlier, as Pacquiao posted home in the 66th fight of a career in which he has won world titles at 6 weights. Meanwhile, Anthony Joshua stopped Charles Martin in 2 rounds at London's O2 Arena to claim the IBF heavyweight title in only his 16th professional fight. The Briton floored his American opponent with a right-hand counter, and after Martin was knocked down again, the referee stopped the fight. The 26-year-old is his country's 6th bona fide heavyweight world champion. Joshua is also just the 3rd man to win a pro heavyweight world title while still a reigning Olympic champion. And he's the first Briton to win both the super heavyweight Olympic gold and a version of the world heavyweight title. London-born Lennox Lewis was fighting for Canada when he won the 1988 Olympic super heavyweight title in Seoul. Joshua's victory now brings a super fight against fellow Briton and WBA and WBO champion Tyson Fury a step closer. Joshua joins Muhammad Ali and Leon Spinks as the only men to be professional heavyweight world champions while still reigning Olympic champions. In African football, DR Congo's TP Mazembe have a tough task ahead if they are to continue the defense of their African Champions League title after 2-0 loss at Wydad Casablanca of Morocco. Goals by Abdelatif Nosil and Reda Hajoj gave the North Africans the advantage after the first leg of their last 16 tie ahead. The overall winners of the tie will progress to the group stages, where the losers will get a second chance in the Confederation Cup. Mazembe are chasing a 6th title, which could make them the second most successful club after 8-time champions Al Ahly of Egypt. Also on Saturday, a record 8-time title holders Al Ahly and a 1-1 draw in Tanzania with Young Africans. Ahly's great rival Zamalek, guided by ex-English Premier League boss Alex McLeish, defeated debutants Maloladi Bejai of Algeria 2-0 in Cairo. Asec Mimosa of Ivory Coast made the most of home advantage to beat Al Ahly Tripoli of Libya 2-0. El Marik of Sudan and Etienne Satif of Algeria drew 2-2 as they met for the second successive season. Stade Malien had hopes of becoming the first qualifiers from Mali, but that was dashed after a shock 3-1 home loss to Zesco United of Zambia. On Sunday, V Club of DR Congo was due to host Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa, and Enyimba of Nigeria is at home to Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia. In the Confederation Cup, newcomers Ted Gabassien of Tunisia looks set to earn a playoff place after holding Zanac of Zambia 1-1 in Lusaka on Saturday. The overall winners will face the losers from the last 16 in the Champions League in a playoff to qualify for the group stage. Algeria's duo CS Constantine and Melodia Oran struggled to cash in on home advantage in other first legs. Constantine saw impressive when eliminating Nasawara United of Nigeria in the round of 32, had to wait 89 minutes before Marod McGee scored to deliver a 1-0 win over Misri Al-Makasha of Egypt. Oran had settled for a goalless draw with Kawakab Marrakech of Morocco, who had conceded 5 goals in 2 previous continental games on the road this season. On Friday, FUS Rabat of Morocco were emphatic 7-0 winners over Uganda's SC Villa in the first leg match. On Sunday, Azam of Tanzania and Al Ahly Shendi of Sudan, the other East African survivors, enjoy home advantage first against Esperance of Tunisia and Medeama of Ghana, respectively. While in Libreville, Monana take on MP of Egypt and the Congolese city of Pointe Noire V-Club Mokanda host Chagrada Esperanca of Angola. And finally, running in his marathon debut, Kenya's Amos Kipruto cruised to victory at the 2016 ACEA Rome Marathon, clocking 2 hours, 8 minutes and 12 seconds at the IAAF Gold Labor Road Race on Sunday. Kipruto broke from a 7-man pack after 35 kilometers to finish more than a minute ahead of Ethiopia's Bihanu Adise Achami. Kenya's Dominic Ruto was third, 1 second further back. Raha Matusa of Ethiopia won the women's race in 2 hours 28.49. Muludiro Melka, also from Ethiopia, was second, clocking 2 hours 29.59. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy. Oh, na, na, na.
Dance, see my head, grace, I shine. I'm in the air, 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 ocean, I go Calabar. I see girls with like that go. You dash me body, I go baller for Lagos. I call Lorenzi, say I don't have a people club. Where all the babies? Say me the call, they are the club. I say she's E40, if not, that me they sing song. I'm bad like King Kong. Here Calabar, here Calabar.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week was yet again a time of reckoning for the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Last week, judges in the ICC dismissed the case against Vice President Ruto of Kenya. There was a lot of jubilation in Ruto's district. The court said that there were not sufficient evidence to proceed with the case. It may be recalled that last year, judges in the ICC also dismissed the case against President Kenyatta on the same grounds, lack of sufficient evidence. Now, the prosecutor's office of the ICC, in response to the court's decision, has reiterated the mantra of the ICC that the lack of evidence was due to tampering of the witnesses, alleging that witnesses have either been bribed or threatened. Now, there is also another narrative which the ICC should consider. Could it be possible that some of these witnesses who have given evidence to the ICC got cold feet when they realized they would have to repeat the evidence before a court of law under oath and under cross and rigorous examination? Instead of blaming others, it is time for the prosecutor's office to undertake an urgent, agonizing reappraisal of its work program and how it had approached the African continent. Africa has become disenchanted with the ICC, even though they were enthusiastic supporters of the Rome Treaty. In fact, there's nothing wrong with the basic document of the ICC. What has caused the problem is that Africans have seen over time that the ICC was focusing inordinately on the African continent. Even a president like Museveni of Uganda, who actually brought a case before the ICC, has become a very strong critic of the ICC. So this is a real problem which could not be dismissed by the ICC by just saying this is African politics. It is not African politics. There are legitimate reasons why Africans are concerned about the proceedings in the ICC. It is also true that some African states support the ICC even though they are in the minority. It is also true that you have many pro-NGOs in Africa. But it would be a mistake for the ICC to rely on these pro-NGOs in taking its case before the courts. Things have got so bad in Africa that the African Union called on its members not to cooperate with the ICC. Now, with the dismissal of the cases against President Ruto and President Kenyatta, there is a legitimate concern that the victims of the post-election violence in Kenya have no remedies. And this is something which the government of Kenya and the parliament must address. And in this case, they should be assisted by some further investigation. We should not forget that the secret list on which the ICC indicted President Kenyatta and Ruto was a product of negotiations conducted by the former Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan. It is time for transparency reasons to know how that list was compiled. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. And from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, the affable Cornelius Tino, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, you can't use your hand to force the sun to set. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State named 14 reformers and civil society activists as recipients of the 2016 International Women of Courage Award. They included women from nations across the globe, from Mauritania to Malaysia and beyond. 13 accepted the award personally from Secretary of State John Kerry, who called the awardees role models whose lives convey a clear message. Don't accept the unacceptable or wait for someone else to step up. Act in the name of justice. But as the 13 honorees sat on the dais at the State Department, Chinese honoree Ni Ulan was absent. Ni Ulan, a human rights defender, is known for her work in championing housing rights and freedom of religion. For her efforts, she has been subjected to harassment, imprisonment, and torture. Although she was not allowed to travel to the United States to receive her award, Secretary of State Kerry praised Ni Ulan in absentia.
Her outspokenness has led her to imprisonment, during which she was beaten so badly that she became paralyzed from the waist down. But that hasn't stopped her. She continues to defend the property rights of Beijing residents whose homes have been slated for demolition. And she has launched the Ni Ulan Human Rights Office to connect activists and lawyers across China to advance the cause of justice. Ni Ulan, for your leadership in advocating for the rule of law and full equal rights in China, we honor you today as a woman of courage.
The Chinese government's treatment of Ni Ulan is part of a concerning pattern of its targeting human rights defenders and civil society activists in China for reprisal. As U.S. Ambassador to China Max Baucus has said, the lawyers who bravely fight for the legal rights of religious believers, journalists, victims of forced evictions, should be embraced as partners, not enemies of the government. Secretary Kerry has observed, strong respect for human rights actually unleashes a country's potential and helps to advance growth and progress. That's a powerful reason why governments should celebrate and not thwart the work of courageous human rights defenders like Ni Ulan.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.